Thanks very much. I must say that as a child and a young adult, I thought that I was safe with the name Gruen. I thought there'd be no chance that anyone would ever know much about the name, let alone have a whole TV show associated with it. And I must say, when I first saw the ads for the Gruen transfer, I thought I had misheard. What could the Gruen transfer possibly be about? I had heard of Victor Gruen, but as far as I know, I'm not related to him. Though I guess we're all grateful that he invented the shopping mall. What would we do without it? Okay, my task today is to talk about the economic costs of climate, of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, understanding the Treasury modelling. Good. I just wanted to know whether this is going to work. Okay, so that's my title. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to you today about the Treasury modelling on the economics of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. The report, Australia's Low Pollution Future, was released by the Treasurer and the Minister for Climate Change and Water on the 30th of October, at the end of last month. Treasury's climate change modelling exercise is the most extensive modelling exercise ever undertaken by the Australian Treasury. It began 18 months ago when the Treasury established a climate change modelling team led by Megan Quinn, who's sitting over there and who will also be up on the panel with us to answer the really difficult questions. And it gradually built in strength from 18 months ago to a peak of 18 dedicated staff recently. We drew on resources from across the public sector, including the Productivity Commission, ABARE, the Reserve Bank and the Department of Climate Change. Much of the work was done in partnership with the Garno Climate Change Review, with expert input from Professor Garno and his extensive team. 8 external consultants contributed to the modelling, including national and international experts in economic modelling of climate change, such as Professor Warwick McKibben and Professor Philip Adams. The Treasury also received invaluable input from industry and environmental groups. The team consulted with and received support from international experts, including those in the OECD, International Energy Agency and the IMF. The report presents integrated economic modelling of climate change policy across global, national, sectoral and household scales. This is a first for Australia. Previous studies have generally focused on one dimension in isolation from the others, but the links are crucial. Australia is a small open economy, so will be significantly affected by what other countries do. Emission and energy-intensive commodities comprise a large share of Australia's exports, so trends in global demand for these commodities have important implications for us all. The government plans to link Australia's carbon pollution reduction scheme to other emission markets around the world. This will allow Australia to access mitigation in other countries, reducing the cost of our contribution to the global mitigation effort. Let me pause here briefly just to make a comment on one of the aspects of our modelling. There's been some critical commentary about our modelling of the timing and extent of mitigation efforts by other countries across the globe. There will always be disagreement about exact details, but in our view, the assumptions about global action are consistent with current international trends. Emission trading is already operating in 27 European countries. New Zealand is introducing emission trading this year. Around 30 states and provinces in the United States and Canada are introducing emissions trading. US President-elect Obama has committed to introducing schemes to reduce emissions, and Japan is trialling emissions trading and intends to introduce a full-scale domestic scheme in 2010 or 2011. For developing countries, who are, after all, in a different position, the constraints on emissions in the policy scenarios that we modelled are imposed gradually over time. In the carbon pollution reduction scheme policy scenarios, China's allocation of emissions continues to rise until about 2030, and India's continues to rise until about 2040. So those are gradual constraints imposed on those countries. Okay, that was by way of parenthesis. Let me return to the main text. Whole of world and whole of economy analysis takes into account the dynamic interactions between supply and demand and the competition for resources. Sectoral analysis provides detailed insights into the transformational process, including possible pathways for technological transformation of key emission-intensive sectors. Household impacts often get much less attention. The Treasury used its own models to examine the potential initial impact, distributional impacts of the carbon pollution reduction scheme. We didn't have sufficient time to build a completely new computable general equilibrium model, and so Treasury drew on a suite of existing models. Through a rigorous quality assurance process, the team worked with consultants to update databases, restructure and expand the coverage of the models, and incorporate the latest research on mitigation potential across the economy. This investment improved the quality of the study, and it will improve the quality of future analysis. We are therefore confident that the report provides a comprehensive and robust account of the potential impact on the Australian economy of national, global and sectoral action to reduce emissions. Nevertheless, like most economic analysis of policies to reduce emissions, the Treasury modelling does not incorporate the potential impacts of climate change itself. That is something that the Garnaut Review spent some considerable time on. None of the scenarios modelled incorporate the costs of climate change uncertainty, the impacts of climate change, or the costs of adapting to a changing environment. Nor do the policy scenarios incorporate how these costs and impacts might change if emissions are reduced. The report is therefore not a cost-benefit analysis, so it needs to be evaluated in the broader context of all the costs and benefits of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Let me say a few words about the science of climate change before returning to the economic modelling. I am not a climate scientist. I do have an honours degree and a PhD in science, so I have some idea of the scientific method and the nature of scientific evidence. And I have taken a keen interest in the debate about the science of climate change in the 18 months I've been involved with the climate change modelling exercise in Treasury. Climate change is clearly a complex and evolving area of scientific inquiry. Given its complexity, as well as the far-reaching implications of alternative possible judgments about the evidence, it is not surprising that there are some significant differences between climate scientists about precisely what we know and with what level of confidence we know it. But how should non-experts like you or I assess the scientific evidence on climate change? On this question, I agree wholeheartedly with Ross Garnaut when he says in his report, quote, "The Garnaut Climate Change Review takes as its starting point, on the balance of probabilities and not as a matter of belief, the majority opinion of the Australian and international scientific communities that human activities resulted in substantial global warming from the mid-20th century and that continued growth in greenhouse gas concentrations caused by human-induced emissions would generate high risks of dangerous climate change." Unquote. I agree with Professor Garnaut that the relevant yardstick with which to assess the scientific evidence on climate change is not what we know for sure, but what we know on the balance of probabilities. And on the balance of probabilities, continued growth in greenhouse gas concentrations would generate high and rising risks of dangerous and potentially irreversible climate change. This seems to me the appropriate place to begin the economic analysis. If we accept the majority scientific opinion as a reasonable starting point, then it seems appropriate to presume that the world will eventually act to decisively slow and then reverse the increase in greenhouse gas emissions, although none of us can be sure precisely when the world will act decisively. To assume otherwise, that is to presume that the world's major emitters will not act at any time to decisively reduce greenhouse gas emissions, is to presume that the world will gradually succumb to potentially catastrophic damage to the global environment. And that is not a presumption with which any of us should feel comfortable. There is another logical possibility, which is that the majority scientific opinion is simply misguided and will turn out to be a fad. However, to invoke such a possibility as a basis for deciding on public policy seems to me extraordinarily foolhardy. This line of logic leads to the conclusion that it makes sense to model the economic costs to Australia of reducing greenhouse gas emissions in a world in which there is a global limit imposed gradually over time on the concentration of greenhouse gases. And that is the and that is precisely the framework in which the Treasury modelling has been conducted. This framework has important implications for what the modelling tells us about the relative costs of early as opposed to delayed action. Assuming that the world eventually acts on climate change, the modelling shows that it makes economic sense for Australia to act early. Economies that defer action face higher long-term costs. This is because more emissions-intensive infrastructure and physical capital is locked in place in the meantime. As a result, late movers face a greater adjustment task when they do act. Global investment is then redirected to early movers. In the scenarios modelled, economic costs in 2050 for early movers are around 15% lower than when everyone acts together, while the cost for late movers are around 20% higher. This finding might come as a surprise to some who expect that Australia will lose competitiveness and face high costs if it acts ahead of other economies. But the finding is in fact analogous to Australia's experience with tariff reductions. Imposing an emissions price gradually changes the orientation of the economy towards lower emission sectors. These are the sectors that will provide the basis for Australia's long-term comparative advantage in a world in which an eventual global constraint is imposed on greenhouse gas emissions, just like tariff cuts which move the economy towards its true comparative advantage. No doubt we will see a lot of competing analysis in the coming days, months and years. We welcome this analysis. Ideas are ultimately contestable. Economic model of climate change policy, particularly over the long term, requires concrete assumptions in areas in which there is genuine and profound uncertainty. Expert opinion will vary, and this will be reflected in differences across studies. This brings me to my next point. Despite different opinions about the timing and nature of global action, the availability and cost of technologies, and the precise details of Australia's carbon pollution reduction scheme, the differences between estimates of the aggregate economic impacts of mitigation policy aren't as great as you might think. There's a lot more consistency across studies, including the Treasury's, than the headlines would lead you to believe. Differences are often more to do with presentation than substance. Consider the following example. GNP is 4.7% lower in 2050. GNP is $208 billion lower in 2050. Annual GDP growth slows by 0.1% per annum out to 2050. GNP is 4.4 times higher in 2052 instead of 2050. These are different ways of presenting precisely the same result. Economic modelling results are often presented as a change relative to the reference case or the base case. That's the 4.7% lower at 2050 measure. This is a sensible approach when you're interested in how a particular policy could influence the economy in isolation from other events. It indicates the scale of the impact and allows comparisons across years and across studies. However, a reduction from the reference case is not the same thing as a reduction from today's levels. Where the reference scenario projects growth, the reduction generally corresponds to slower growth rather than an absolute reduction. For long-term analysis, differences in growth rates can be more informative and less prone to misunderstanding. The report finds that Australia and the world continue to enjoy robust economic growth while making the emissions cuts required to reduce the risks of dangerous climate change. Even ambitious reduction goals have a limited impact on national and global economic growth. So here's a chart which, if you can't see the details, is in the report in more than one place. On the left-hand side, you see the reference case, which can be thought of as business as usual, in which Australian emissions rise strongly from 2010. And the four other lines are the four policy scenarios that we modelled in detail. And they show, and this is quite an important point, they show Australia's allocation in a global allocation of emissions. The actual emissions emitted by the Australian economy do not fall as strongly as these allocations suggest, and the reason they don't is because Australia has relatively high costs of mitigation and therefore we buy some of the mitigation from overseas. So those are not the lines which represent by how much Australian emissions would need to fall. They are projections of how much in a global allocation, Australia's allocation would fall over time. On the right-hand side, we show real GNP per capita. The reason for GNP rather than GDP is one of those things that I will leave to the cognoscenti. Those of you who need to know probably already know. Those of you who don't need to know probably would prefer to leave it that way. But you can think of it as per capita growth the level of per capita economic activity. And you can see the reference case grows more strongly than the policy cases, and the policy cases sit close to each other. They are not identical, but they sit close to each other. GNP per capita grows at an annual rate of 1.1% in the policy scenarios, 0.1% less than the 1.2% annual growth in the reference scenario. Now, they're not all exactly 1.1. They differ slightly across the four policy scenarios, but they all round to 1.1 when expressed to one decimal place. We didn't quote results to any more decimal points than this because that would imply a false sense of precision. World gross output grows at 3.3 to 3.4% per annum in the policy scenarios compared to 3.5% in the reference scenario. This is wholly consistent with the results of previous studies, and in my printed remarks, which are available on the Treasury website, I give an example of a worst-case scenario which gives higher economic costs than those in the Treasury modelling, but not that much, but still in a similar ballpark to our results. The Treasury report does not examine unilateral action by Australia. Unilateral action is not consistent with the government's policy, and it's also not consistent with what we can already observe internationally, as I detailed earlier. How does a decline in annual growth in GNP per capita of 0.1% compare to other challenges facing the Australian economy? Treasury's analysis of the likely impact of Australia's ageing population provides an interesting point of comparison. The Intergenerational Report, which was put out last year, projected that the big fall in fertility in the 1960s and 1970s, combined with continual increases in life expectancies, will lead to an annual growth rate of GNP per capita over the next 40 years that is 0.5% slower than over the past 40 years. Thus, the effect of changed demographics in the Australian population is projected to lead to a slowdown in annual per capita growth five times larger than the slowdown projected here. As the Intergenerational Report made clear, adjusting to demographic change will require economic and social adjustments in the Australian economy, but these adjustments should prove manageable. Much the same comment applies to the economics of significantly reducing greenhouse gas emissions. It's important to keep in mind the magnitude of these aggregate economic costs when evaluating the sectoral impact of mitigation policy, and in particular structural adjustment needs. The Australian economy will adjust gradually from its current structure. Mitigation policies introduced in coming years will change the pattern of future economic activity, so the reference scenario of 2050 will not eventuate. Of course, it might not eventuate even if we didn't do anything. Today's economy provides a useful reference point from which to evaluate sectoral impacts. The modelling indicates that the gross output of many sectors in the economy falls relative to the reference scenario that's shown on the left-hand side. So here's four sectors, and they all, in 2050, they all fall. These are changes from 2050. They all fall relative to the reference case, but they all significantly rise relative to gross output now. For these sectors and for most others that fall relative to the reference scenario, growth continues, albeit at a slower pace than we might expect in a world without emissions pricing. Growth in other sectors such as iron ore mining, other animals, forestry and renewable electricity generation accelerates. Only aluminium production, petroleum refining and coal-fired electricity are projected to contract relative to today's levels of production because of emissions pricing. Now let me talk a little bit about the assumptions in the modelling. Models cannot clear away the fog of ignorance through which we all gaze at the future. They are not crystal balls. Models need firm assumptions, and these assumptions become more difficult the further out we look. Imagine trying to foresee the current state of the world from the perspective of 1908. 1908 saw the beginning of the popular use of cars with the production of the Model T Ford. The first two-person plane flew in May of that year. Australia's GDP per capita was around the same level as China's is today. Agriculture accounted for over 15% of Australian employment. In 2008, Australia and the world looks very different from this. Likewise, it is impossible today to foresee the state of the world in 2050 or 2100. But from the perspective of today, economic models, while clearly imperfect, are the best analytical tools available. I sometimes imagine the choices we face like this. You can inform policy decisions by using admittedly fallible economic models, or you can ask your uncle. I, for one, have never hesitated over this choice. Treasury consulted widely with government, industry and other non-government stakeholders to gather information about input assumptions, did extensive research and drew on domestic and international experts. Expert opinion on many relevant issues varies widely. The assumptions represent Treasury's best assessment of plausible central estimates within the range of possible values. Where possible, we use sensitivity analysis to explore how different assumptions, including for resource prices, timing and coverage of policy action, and the cost and performance of key technologies might change the cost estimates. Our assumptions regarding carbon capture and storage technologies have attracted some attention, and I have included an appendix on this issue for those people who want to read it. Clearly, the particular mix of mitigation activities projected in the modelling reflects the assumptions made. Supply-side opportunities to reduce emissions and demand-side responses to changes in relative prices are uncertain, particularly over the longer term. As a result, it is impossible to accurately predict how much mitigation will occur in each sector and in each year. This is precisely why it is more efficient to create mitigation incentives across the whole economy rather than target specific emission sources or sectors. Broadly based, market-oriented policies such as the Carbon Pollution Reduction Scheme allow the market to respond as new information becomes available. This brings me to my final point, which concerns the relevance of the global financial crisis. Like much long-term analysis, including that presented in the Intergenerational Report, the modelling focuses on medium to long-term trends in the economy rather than shorter-run fluctuations. The actual path of Australian and global economic growth from now out to 2050 will be affected by a wide range of factors. Business cycles and economic shocks, such as the current global financial crisis, will have significant impacts on the economy in the short term. However, this should not materially affect the analysis in the report. This is because, over long time frames, trends provide a reasonable approximation of actual economic growth. Here is a picture of the trend for G7 economic output, and I'll show you why this is relevant in a minute. And here is what is actual G7 economic output. As the chart shows, actual growth in the G7 rises and falls as economic shocks, such as the oil shock of the mid-70s, the global recession of the 80s, and the dot-com boom and bust of the early 2000s, work their way through the economy. On the far right-hand side of the chart, you will see the IMF's October 2008 forecasts for the next 5 years. The global financial crisis means that G7 economic growth is forecast to be clearly below trend, but only for a few years. But it's the trend, not the wiggles, which is important in assessing climate change mitigation. It is the trend in economic activity over the next 4 decades, not the next 4 months or 4 years, along with a myriad of other detail about the longer-term structure of the Australian and global economies, which is important for assessing what profile for emission prices is required to generate any given environmental outcome. And it is economic analysis over these timeframes that is relevant for an assessment of the longer-term economic costs of reducing greenhouse gas emissions. Treasury's climate change modelling exercise represents a major undertaking with input from a wide range of experts. We have taken great care to use assumptions that represent our best assessment of plausible central estimates within the range of possible values. No modelling exercise can offer the last word on an issue as complex as the economics of reducing greenhouse gas emissions, but we are confident that the report provides a comprehensive and robust account of the potential impact on the Australian economy of national, global and sectoral action to reduce these emissions. Thank you for your attention.